battlefield undismayed, as indeed they had. At the moment they seemed to indicate deeply considered thought. The white and gold tabard of a lord captain, anointed of the light, suited him.
"My lord captain commander, they wish to establish a chapter house here."
Even his voice, deep and mellifluous, fit the image.
"Illuminators travel everywhere. It should be possible to slip agents among them easily. Agents welcomed into every town, every noble's manor, every ruler's palace."
Supposedly, Abdel Omerna was a relatively minor member of the Council of Anointed. In truth, he was the Children of the Light's spy master, after a manner of speaking.
"Think of it!"
What Niall thought was that the Guild of Illuminators was Terrabanner to the last man and woman, and Terrabon was infected with chaos and madness that he would not let loose in Amadicia. If cauterizing that infection had to wait, he could at least isolate it.
"They will be treated like anyone else who slips through, Omerna. Kept under guard, allowed to talk to no one, and escorted out of Amadicia without delay. If I may insist, my lord captain commander, their usefulness is worth the little gossip they might spread. They keep to themselves, and aside from their use for my agents, the prestige of having an Illuminator's chapter house in Amador would be considerable. The only chapter house now. The one in Kyrian has been abandoned, and the one in Tanchico surely has been too."
"Prestige?" Niall rubbed his left eye to soothe an involuntary flutter. Little point in getting angry with Omerna, but restraint took an effort. The morning heat cooked his temper over a slow fire.
"They do indeed keep to themselves, Omerna. They live with their own, travel with their own, and barely speak to anyone else. Do you mean to have these agents marry Illuminators? They rarely marry outside their guild, and there is no way to become an Illuminator except by birth." "Ah, well, I am sure a way can be found."
Nothing could dent that facade of confidence and competence.
"It shall be done as I say, Omerna."
The man actually opened his mouth again, but Niall forestalled him irritably.
"As I say, Omerna. I'll hear no more on it. Now, what information do you have today? What useful information? That is your function, not providing fireworks for Iron."
Omerna hesitated, plainly wanting to make another plea for his precious illuminators, but in the end he said portentously,
"The reports of Dragonsworn in Altara are more than rumor, it seems, and perhaps in Murundi as well. The infestation is small, but it will grow. A strong move now could settle for them and the Aes Sedai in Saladar in one..." "Do you dictate strategy for the children now? Gather information and leave its use to me. What else do you have for me?"
The man's response to being cut off was a calm bow of acquiescence. Omerna was very good at remaining calm. It was perhaps what he did best.
"I have good news. Matin Stepaneus is ready to join you. He hesitates to make a public announcement, but my people in Ilion report that he soon will. He is reported eager."
"That would be remarkably good," Niall said dryly.
Remarkable, certainly. Among the banners and pennants lining the cornices of the chamber, Matin Stepaneus's three leopards, silver on black, hung next to a gold-fringed Ilianor royal standard, 9 bees worked in thread of gold on green silk. The Ilianor king came out on top in the troubles, finally, at least to the point of forcing a treaty that affirmed the border between Amadicia and Altara, where it was at the beginning. But Niall doubted the man would ever forget that he had had the advantage of terrain and numbers at Soramain, and still been defeated and captured. If the Ilianor companions had not covered the field for the rest of the army to escape Niall's trap, Altara would be a fief of the children today, and very likely Murundi and even Ilion. Worse, Matin Stepaneus had a Tarvalan witch for an advisor, though he hid the fact and her. Niall sent emissaries because he dared not leave a path untried, But yes, Matin Stepanez joining him, willingly, would be remarkable indeed.
Continue, and be brief. I have a busy day today, and I can read your written reports later.
Despite those instructions, O'Myrna's rendition was long, delivered in a sonorous voice, full of certainty.
Althor had barely extended his control in Andor beyond Camelin.
His lightning onslaught was clearly stalled at last, as O'Myrna carefully pointed out that he had predicted.
There was little chance the Borderlands would join the children against the false dragon any time soon.
Lords in Shinar, Arafel, and Kandor were taking advantage of the Blight's quiet to rebel, and the Queen of Saldaea had gone into seclusion in the country, in fear of the same, according to O'Myrna. His agents were at work, however, and the Borderlands rulers would be brought to heel as soon as these small rebellions were quashed. On the other hand, the rulers of Mirrendi, Altara, and Giladon were ready to fall into line, though making ambivalent noises at present to soothe the Tarvalan witches. Alejandra of Giladon knew her throne was shaky, knew she needed the children to avoid plummeting as abruptly as her predecessors, while both Tylan of Altara and Rodran of Mirrendi hoped that the children's weight would make them more than figureheads at last. Plainly the man considered those lands already as good as in Niall's coat pocket. Within Amadicia, the picture was even better, by O'Myrna's reckoning. Recruits flocked to the children's banners in greater numbers than for years. Strictly speaking, this was none of O'Myrna's concern, but he always larded his reports with any good news he could find. The prophet would not trouble the land much longer. At present, his rabble squabbled over looting villages and manors in the north, and might well scatter back into Giladon at the next push by Aelron soldiers. Little room remained in the jails because Dark Friends and Tarvalan spies were being arrested faster than they could be hanged. The search for Tarvalan witches had found only two so far, but over 100 women had been put to the question, an indication of how vigilant the patrols were. And fewer refugees from Terraban were being apprehended, proof the quarantine was becoming more effective. Those caught were being thrown back into Terraban as fast as they could be taken back to the border. He hurried past that last, unsurprising, given his stupidity with the Illuminators. Niall listened just enough to know where to nod. O'Myrna had been an adequate commander in the field, so long as someone told him what to do, but in his present position, his credulous stupidity was trying. He had reported Morgay's dead, her corpse seen and identified beyond doubt, up to the very day Niall brought him face to face with her. He had ridiculed rumors that the Stone of Tyr had fallen, and still denied that the mightiest fortress in the world could have been taken by any outside force. There had been treason, he insisted, a High Lord, who had betrayed the stone to Althor and Tarvalan. He maintained that the disaster at Falma and the troubles in Terraban and Arad-Daman were the work of Artur Hawkwing's armies come back across the Arath Ocean. He was convinced that Swan Sanche had not been deposed at all, that Althor was insane and dying, that Tarvalan had murdered King Galdrian to deliberately set off the civil war in Cairhien, and that these three facts were somehow tied into those ridiculous rumors, always from somewhere conveniently far away, of people bursting into flame or nightmares leaping out of thin air and slaughtering whole villages. He was not sure how exactly, but he was working on a grand theory he promised to deliver any day, a theory that supposedly would unravel all the witches' schemes and deliver Tarvalan into Niall's hands. That was the way with O'Myrna. He either invented convoluted reasons for what happened, or else seized on gossip in the streets and swallowed it whole. He spent a good deal of his time listening to gossip, in manor houses and in the streets. Not only had he been seen drinking in the taverns with Huntress for the Horn, it was an ill-kept secret that he had laid out huge sums for no fewer than 3 supposed horns of Valyr. Each time he had carried the thing off to the country and puffed on it for days, till even he had to admit that no dead heroes out of legend were going to come riding back from the grave. Even so, the failures were unlikely to stop him from future purchases in dark alleys or the back rooms of taverns. The simple form of it was this: where a spymaster should doubt his own face in the mirror, O'Myrna believed anything. Eventually the man ran down, and Niall said,
"I will give your reports due consideration, O'Myrna. You have done well.
How the fellow preened, smoothing his tabard.
Leave me now. On your way out, send Bulwer in. I have some letters to dictate.
Of course, my lord captain commander.
Ah!
In the middle of his bow, Amerna frowned and fumbled in the pocket of his white undercoat, pulling out a tiny bone cylinder that he handed to Niall.
This arrived at the pigeon cote this morning.
Three thin red stripes ran the length of the cylinder, meaning it was to be brought to Niall with the wax seals intact. And the man had almost forgotten it. Omerna waited, no doubt hoping for a hint of what the cylinder contained, but Niall waved him toward the door.
Do not forget Bulwer. If Matin Stepaneos might join me, I must write and see if I can add a little weight to his making the right decision.
Omerna had no choice but to make his bow anew and go. Even when the door closed behind the man, Niall only fingered the cylinder. These rare special messages seldom brought good news. Rising slowly, of late he sometimes felt age in his bones, he filled the plain silver goblet with punch, but then left it sitting on the table and flipped open a folder of scroll-worked leather lined with linen. It contained a single sheet of heavy paper, crumpled and partly torn. A street artist's drawing, in colored chalks, of two men fighting in clouds, one with a face made of fire, the other with dark reddish hair. Althor. All his plans to hinder the false dragon had gone awry, all his hopes to slow the man's tide of conquest, to divert him. Had he waited too long, let Althor grow too powerful? If so, there was only one way to deal with him quickly— the knife in the dark, the arrow from a rooftop. How long did he dare wait? Did he dare risk not waiting? Too much haste could spell disaster as surely as too long a delay.
My lord sent for me.
Niall eyed the man who entered so silently. On the face of it, it hardly seemed possible that Bulwer could move without a dry rustle announcing his presence. Everything about him was narrow and pinched. His brown coat hung from knobby shoulders, and his legs looked as if they might snap under his desiccated weight. He moved like a bird hopping from limb to limb.
"Do you believe the Horn of Valir will call dead heroes back to us, Bulwer?"
"Perhaps, my lord," Bulwer said, folding his hands fussily. "Perhaps not. I would not count on it myself."
Niall nodded.
"And do you think Matin Stepaneos will join me?"
"Again, perhaps. He will not want to finish dead or a puppet. His first and only concern is to hold on to the laurel crown, and the army gathering in Tyr must make him sweat for that."
Bulwer smiled thinly, a bare compression of lips.
"He has spoken openly about accepting my lord's proposal, but, on the other hand, I've just learned he has been communicating with the White Tower. Apparently he has agreed to something, though I don't yet know what."
The world knew that Abdel-Omerna was the children's spymaster. Such a position should have been secret, of course, but stable boys and beggars pointed him out in the street, warily, lest the most dangerous man in Amadisia see them. The truth was that Omerna was a decoy, a fool who did not know himself that he was only a mask hiding the true master of spies in the Fortress of the Light. Seban Bulwer, Niall's prim, dried-up little secretary with his disapproving mouth. A man no one would ever suspect or credit if he was named to them. Where Omerna believed everything, Bulwer believed nothing, perhaps not even in Dark Friends or the Dark One. If Bulwer did believe in anything, it was looking over men's shoulders, listening to their whispers, rooting out their secrets. Of course, he would have served any master as well as he did Niall, but that was all to the good. What Bulwer learned was never tainted by what he knew had to be true or wanted to be true. Disbelieving everything, he always managed to root out truth.
"No more than I expected, Adavilion Bulwer.
but even he can be brought round.
He would have to be. It could not be too late.
Is there any fresh word from the borderlands?
Not yet, my lord.
But Davram Bashir is in Camelod, with 30,000 light horse, my informants claim, but I think no more than half that. He would not weaken Saldea too far, however quiet the blight, even if Tenobia commanded him to.
Niall grunted, the corner of his left eye trembling. He fingered the sketch lying in its folder. Supposedly it was a fair likeness of Althor. Bashir and Camelin. A good reason for Tenobia to be hiding in the country from his envoy. There was no good news from the borderlands, whatever Omerna thought. The minor rebellions, Omerna reported, were minor, but not rebellions of the sort the man thought. Along the Blight border, men were arguing over whether Althor was another false dragon or the dragon reborn. Borderlanders being as they were, sometimes these arguments flared into small-scale battles. The fighting had begun in Shinar about the time the Stone of Tyr was falling, confirmation of the witch's involvement, if any, was needed. How it would all be settled was yet in doubt, according to Balwer. That Althor remained confined to Camelin was one of the few things Omerna had right. Yet why, with Bashir and Aiel and the witches? Not even Balwer had been able to answer that. Whatever the reason, the light be praised for it. The Prophet's mobs had settled in to loot the north of Amadicia, true, but they were consolidating their hold, killing or putting to flight any who refused to declare for the Prophet of the Dragon. Alron's soldiers had only stopped retreating because the accursed Prophet had stopped advancing. Aleandra and the others Omerna was certain would join him were in fact dithering, putting off his ambassadors with flimsy excuses and delays. He suspected that they knew no more how they would leap than he did. On the surface, everything seemed to be going Althor's way at the moment, except for whatever held him in Camelin. But Niall had always been at his most dangerous when he was outnumbered and with his back to the wall. If the rumors could be believed, Caradin was doing well in Altara and Mirandi, though not as quickly as Niall would have liked. Time was as much an enemy as Althor or the Tower. Yet even if Caradin was only doing well in the rumors, that should be enough. Perhaps it was time to extend the Dragon Sworn into Andor. Perhaps Ilion as well, though if the army gathering in Tyr was not enough to show Matin Stepanaeus the path, a few farms and villages raided would hardly make a difference. The size of that army horrified Niall. If it was half what Balwer reported, a quarter, it still horrified him. Nothing like it had been seen since Arthur Hawkwing's day. Rather than frighten men into joining Niall, an army like that might intimidate them into falling in behind the dragon banner. Could he have found a year, just half a year, he would have accounted it worth Althor's whole army of fools and villains and Aiel savages. All was not lost, of course. All was never lost as long as you were alive. Darabon and Arad-Doman were as useless to Althor and the witches as to him, two pits full of scorpions. Only a fool would put a hand in there until more of the scorpions killed one another off. If Saldea was lost, which he would not concede, Shinar and Arafel and Kandor still hung in the balance, and balances could be tipped. If Matin Stepanaeus wanted to ride two horses at once, he'd always like to try that, he could yet be forced to choose the right one. Altara and Mirandi would be prodded to the proper side, and Andor would drop into his hand whether or not he decided a touch of Caradin's whip was required. In Tyr, Balwer's agents had convinced Tadosian and Istanda to join Darlan, turning a show of defiance into real rebellion, and the man was confident the same could be done in Cairhien and in Andor. Another month, two at the outside, and Eamon Valda would arrive from Tarvalen. Niall could have done without Valda, but then the great majority of the children's strength would be in one spot, ready to use where it could do the most good. Yes, he had a good deal on his side yet. Nothing had solidified, but everything coalesced. Time was all that was needed. Realizing he still held the bone cylinder, he cracked the wax seal with a thumbnail and carefully drew out the thin paper rolled up inside. Balwar said nothing, but his mouth compressed again, not in a smile this time. Omerna he put up with, knowing the man a fool, much preferring to remain hidden himself. But he did not like Niall receiving reports that bypassed him, from men he did not know. A tiny, spidery scrawl covered the slip in a cipher that few besides Niall knew, none of them in Amador. For him, reading it was as easy as reading his own hand. The sign at the bottom made him blink, and so did the contents. Varadin was, or had been, one of the best of his personal agents, a rug seller who did good service during the Troubles while peddling his wares through Altara, Murundi, and Ilion. What he earned there had set him up as a wealthy merchant in Tanchico, regularly supplying fine carpets and wines to the palaces of king and panarch, as well as to most of the nobles of their courts, and always leaving with his eyes and ears full. Niall had thought him long since dead in the upheaval there. This was the first word from him in a year. From what Varadin wrote, it would have been better if he truly had been a year dead. In the jerky hand of a man on the brink of madness, it was a wild, disjointed ramble about men riding strange beasts and flying creatures, Aes Sedai on leashes, and the Hylene. That meant forerunners in the old tongue, but there was not even an attempt to explain why Varadin was terrified of them, or who they were supposed to be. Plainly the man had taken a brain fever from watching his country disintegrate around him. Annoyed, Niall crumpled the paper and threw it aside.
First I must sit through Omerna's idiocy, and now this. What else do you have for me, Balwar?
Bashir. Matters could become nasty with Bashir to General Althor's armies. The man had earned his reputation. A dagger in the shadows for him? Balwar's eyes never left Niall's face by so much as a flicker, but Niall knew the tiny ball of paper on the floor would end up in the man's hands unless he burned it.
4 things that might be of interest, my lord. The least first. The rumors about meetings between the Ogier Steading are true. For Ogier, they seem to be showing some haste.
He did not say what the meetings were about, of course. Getting a human into an Ogier stump was as impossible as getting an Ogier to spy. Easier to have the sun rise at night.
Also, there are an unusual number of sea folk ships in the southern ports, not taking cargo, not sailing.
What are they waiting for?
For a moment, Balwar's mouth tightened as though drawstrings had been pulled shut.
I do not know yet, my lord.
Balwar never liked admitting there were any human secrets he could not ferret out. Trying to learn more than the surface of what went on among the Atha on Mier was like trying to learn how the Guild of Illuminators made fireworks, an exercise in futility. At least the Ogier might eventually make known the decisions of their meetings.
Continue.
The news of middling interest is peculiar, my lord. Althor has reliably been reported in Camelon, in Tyr, and in Cairhien, sometimes on the same day.
Reliably? Reliable madness? The witches probably have 2 or 3 men who look like Althor, enough to fool anyone who doesn't know him. That would explain a good deal.
Perhaps, my lord. My informants are reliable.
Niall slapped the leather folder closed, hiding Althor's face.
And the news of greatest interest?
I have it from 2 sources in Altara, reliable sources, my lord, that the witches in Saladar claim the Red Aja encouraged Loghain to become a false dragon. All but created him, in fact. They have Loghain in Saladar, or a man they say is Loghain, and are showing him to nobles they bring there. I have no proof, but I suspect they are telling the same tale to any ruler they can reach.
Frowning, Niall studied the banners overhead. Those represented enemies from nearly every land. Not one had ever defeated him twice, and few once. The banners were all faded with age now, like him. Yet he was not too faded to see an end to what he had begun. Every banner taken in bloody battle, well, you never really knew what was happening beyond sight of your own eyes, where certain victory and certain defeat could be equally ephemeral. The worst battle he had ever fought, armies blundering into one another in the night near Moisin during the Troubles, had been clear as a bright summer's day compared to the one he fought now. Could he have been wrong? Could the tower really be broken? A struggle of some sort between the Ajahs? Over what? Althor? If the witches were fighting among themselves, there would be many in the children ready to advocate Caradhan's solution. A strike to destroy Saladar, and as many of the witches as possible. Men who believed thinking of tomorrow was thinking ahead, but never considered next week or next month, let alone next year. Valda, for one. Perhaps it was just as well he had not reached Amador yet. For another, Radam Asinawa, the High Inquisitor of the Questioners. Valda always wanted to use an axe, even when a poniard was best for the task at hand. Asinawa just wanted every woman who had ever spent a night in the tower hanged as of yesterday, every book that mentioned Aes Sedai or the One Power burned, and the words themselves banned. Asinawa never had a thought beyond those goals, nor a care for costs. Niall had worked too hard, risked too much, to allow this to become a struggle between the children and the tower in the eyes of the world. In truth, it did not matter whether he was wrong. If he was, it still could be very much to his advantage, perhaps more than if he was right. With a little luck, he could shatter the White Tower past repairing, splinter the witches into shards easily ground to dust. Althor would surely falter then, while remaining enough of a threat to be used as a goad. And he could hold closely to the truth, fairly closely. Without taking his eyes from the banners, he said, "The split in the tower is real. The Black Aja rose up. The victors hold the tower, and the losers were driven out to lick their wounds in Saladar." He looked at Bulwer and nearly smiled. One of the children would have been protesting that there was no Black Aja, or rather, that all the witches were dark friends. The newest recruit would have. Bulwer merely looked at him, not at all as if he had just blasphemed against all the children stood for. "The only decision to make is whether the Black Aja won or lost. I think they won. Most people will think of whoever holds the tower as the real Aes Sedai. Let them associate real Aes Sedai with Black Aja. Althor is a creature of the tower, a vassal of the Black Aja." Lifting his wine cup from the table, he took a sip. It did not help the heat. "Perhaps I can fit it in with why I haven't moved against Saladar yet." Through his emissaries, he had been using the failure to move as proof of how dire he saw the threat from Althor. He was willing to let the witches congregate on Amadisia's doorstep rather than be diverted from the danger of the false dragon. "The women there, appalled after all these years at how pervasive the Black Aja is, repelled at last by the evil they've been immersed in..." His inventiveness ran out. They were all servants of the Dark One. What evil could repel them? But after a moment, Bulwer took it up.
"Perhaps they've decided to throw themselves on my lord's mercy, even ask my lord's protection. Losers in a rebellion, weaker than their enemies, fearing to be crushed. A man falling off a cliff to certain death will stretch out a hand even to his worst enemy. Perhaps..."
Bulwer tapped bony fingers against his lips in thought.
"Perhaps they are ready to repent their sins and renounce being Aes Sedai?"
Niall stared at him. He suspected the Tarvalan witch's sins were among the things Balwer did not believe in.
"That is absurd," he said flatly. "It's the sort of thing I might expect from Omerna."
His secretary's face remained as prim as ever, but he began dry-washing his hands the way he did when he felt insulted.
"What my lord might expect to hear from him, but just the sort of thing that will be repeated where he does most of his listening, in the streets and where nobles gossip over wine. Absurdities are never laughed at there, only listened to. What is too absurd to believe is believed because it is too absurd to be a lie."
"How would you present it? I will start no rumor of the children dealing with the witches."
"It would only be a rumor, my lord."
Niall's gaze hardened, and Balwer spread his hands.
"As my lord wishes. Each retelling always adds embellishment, so a simple tale has the best chance of the core surviving. I suggest 4 rumors, my lord, not one. The first, that the division in the tower was caused by a Black Arja uprising. The second, that the Black Arja won and control the tower. Third, the Aes Sedai in Saladar, repelled and horrified, are renouncing being Aes Sedai. And fourth, they have approached you, seeking mercy and protection. For most people, each will be a confirmation of the others."
Tugging on his lapels, Balwer gave a narrow, self-satisfied smile.
"Very good, Balwer. Let it be so."
Niall took a deeper drink of wine. The heat was making him feel his age. His bones seemed brittle, but he would last long enough to see the false dragon put down and the world united to face Tommen Gaten. Even if he did not live to lead in the last battle, the light would surely grant him that much.
"And I want Elaine Trakand and her brother Gawain found, Balwer, and brought to Amador. See to it. You may leave me now."
Instead of going, Balwer hesitated.
"My lord knows I never suggest any course of action."
"But you mean to suggest one now? What is it?"
"Press more gaze, my lord. More than a month has passed, and she still considers my lord's proposal. She—"
"Enough, Balwer!"
Niall sighed. Sometimes he wished Balwer were not an Amadisian, but a Kyrenian, who had taken in the game of houses with his mother's milk.
"More gaze is more committed to me every day, whatever she believes. I would like it better had she accepted immediately. I could have Andor raised against Ulthor today, with the thick leavening of children to stiffen it. But every day that she remains my guest ties her to me more tightly. Eventually she will discover she is allied to me because the world believes she is, tangled so tightly she can never escape. And no one will ever be able to say, 'I coerced her, Balwer.' That is important. It is always harder to abandon an alliance the world thinks you entered freely than one you can prove you were forced into. Reckless haste leads to ruin, Balwer."
"As my lord says."
Niall gestured a dismissal, and the man bowed his way out. Balwer did not understand. Morgays was a rugged opponent. Pressed too hard, she would turn and fight, whatever the odds. Yet pressed just hard enough, she would fight the enemy she thought she saw, and never see the trap building around her until it was too late. Time pressed down on him. All the years he had lived, all the months he desperately needed. But he would not let haste ruin his plans.
The stooping falcon struck the large duck in an explosion of feathers, and the two birds separated, the duck tumbling toward the ground. Banking sharply in the cloudless sky, the falcon swooped back onto her falling prey, clutched it in her talons. The weight of the duck burdened her, but she struggled back toward the people waiting below. Morgaze wondered whether she was like the falcon, too proud and too determined to realize when she had latched onto a prize too heavy for her wings to support. She tried to make her gloved hands loosen their grip on her reins. Her wide-brimmed white hat, with its long white plumes, provided a little protection from the unrelenting sun, but sweat beaded on her face. In a riding dress of green silk, embroidered in gold, she did not look a prisoner. Figures mounted and afoot filled the long pasture of dried brown grass, though they did not crowd it. A cluster of musicians in white-embroidered blue tabards with flutes and bitterns and tambours produced a light tune suitable for an afternoon over chilled wine. A dozen handlers in long, elaborately worked leather vests over billowing white shirts stroked hooded falcons perched on their gauntleted arms, or puffed short pipes and blew streams of blue smoke at their birds. Twice as many brightly liveried servants moved about with fruits and wine in golden goblets on golden trays, and a band of men clad in bright mail encircled the pasture just short of the largely bare-branched trees, all in aid of Morgaze and her retinue to ensure their hawking went safely. Well, that was the reason given, though the Prophet's people were a good 200 miles north, and brigands seemed unlikely this close to Amador. And despite the women clustered around her on their mares and geldings, in bright silk riding dresses and wide-brimmed hats resplendent with colored plumes, their hair in the long ringlets currently in fashion in the Amadisian court, Morgaze's retinue in truth consisted of Basil Gill, awkward on his horse off to one side, with his jerkin of metal discs straining around his girth over the red silk coat she had procured him so he would not be outshone by the servants, and Piter Conal, even more awkward in a page's red and white coat, and displaying the nervousness he had shown since she added him to her party. The women were nobles from Aelron's court, volunteers to be Morgaze's ladies-in-waiting. Poor Master Gill fingered his sword and eyed the white-cloaked guards disconsolately. That was what they were, though as usual when escorting her out of the Fortress of Light, not wearing their white cloaks. And they were guards. If she tried to ride too far or remain out too long, their commander, a hard-eyed young man named Norowyn, who hated pretending to be other than a white cloak, would suggest that she return to Amador because the heat was growing too great, or because of a sudden rumor of bandits in the area. There was no arguing with 50 armored men, not with any dignity. Norowyn had come within a hair of taking her reins from her the first time. That was the reason she never let Talanvor accompany her on these rides. That young fool might insist on her honor and rights if there were 100 men against him. He spent his spare hours practicing the sword as though he expected to carve a way to freedom for her. Startlingly, a sudden breeze brushed her face, and she realized that Lorraine had leaned from her saddle to fan her with a white lace fan. A slender young woman with dark eyes set slightly too close together, Lorraine wore a permanent simper. "It must be so gratifying for Your Majesty to learn that her son has joined the Children of the Light, and to have attained rank so quickly." "That should be no surprise," Altalin said, fanning her own plump face. "Her Majesty's son would, of course, rise quickly, as the sun in splendor does." She basked in the appreciative murmurs from some of the other women for her pitiful pun. Morgaze kept her face smooth with difficulty. Niall's news last evening during one of his surprise visits had come as a shock. Galad a white cloak. At least he was safe, so Niall said, but unable to visit her. The duties of a child of the light kept him away. But assuredly he would be part of her escort when she returned to Andor at the head of an army of the children. No, Galad was no more safe than Elaine or Gawain. Perhaps less. The light send that Elaine was secure in the White Tower. The light send that Gawain was alive. Niall claimed not to know where he was, except that he was not in Tar Valon. Galad was a knife to her throat, Niall would never be so crude as to even suggest it, but one simple order from him could send Galad where he would surely die. The one protection he had was that Niall might think she did not care as much for him as for Elaine and Gawain. "I am pleased for him, if it is what he seeks," she told them in an indifferent tone. "But he is Tarringale's son, not mine. Tarringale was a marriage of state, you understand. Strange, but he's been dead so long I can hardly recall his face. Galad is free to do as he will. It is Gawain who will be first Prince of the Sword when Elaine follows me on the Lion Throne." She waved away a servant with a goblet on a tray. "Niall could at least have provided us with decent wine." A wave of anxious titters answered her. She'd had some success in drawing them closer to her, yet none could be easy about offending Pedro Niall, not where it might get back to him. Morgays took every opportunity to do so in their hearing. It convinced them of her bravery, important if she was to gain even partial allegiance. Perhaps more importantly, for her own mind at least, it helped maintain the illusion that she was not Niall's prisoner. "I hear that Randall Thor displays the Lion Throne like a trophy from the hunt." That was Miranda, a pretty woman with a heart-shaped face somewhat older than the others. The sister of the high seat of House Algoron, she was powerful in her own right, perhaps powerful enough to have resisted Aelron, but not Niall. The others reined their mounts aside for her to heel her bay gelding closer to Morgay's. There was no question of gaining any sort of allegiance or friendship from Miranda. "I have heard as much," Morgays replied blithely. "The lion is a dangerous animal to hunt, and the Lion Throne more so, especially for a man. It always kills men who seek it." Miranda smiled. "I also hear he gives high places to men who can channel." That produced uneasy glances among the other women, and a worried buzz. One of the younger women, Marowyn, slight and little more than a girl, swayed in her high-cantled saddle as if she might faint. News of Althor's amnesty had spawned frightening tales. Rumors only, Morgays fervently hoped. The Light Sendit was all rumor. Men who could channel gathering in Camelin, carousing in the royal palace, terrorizing the city. "You hear a great deal," Morgays said. "Do you spend all your time listening at cracked doors?" Miranda's smile deepened. She had been unable to resist pressure to become one of Morgays's attendants, but she was powerful enough to show her displeasure without fear. She was like a thorn driven deep into the foot, impossible to dislodge, and giving a sharp jab at every step. "I have little time left from the pleasure of serving your majesty to listen anywhere, but I do try to catch what news I can of Andor, so I may converse with your majesty. I hear the false dragon consorts daily with Andorran nobles, Lady Aramilla and Lady Nan, Lord Jarin and Lord Lyr, others, friends of theirs." One of the falconers lifted a hooded, sleek, gray bird with black wings up to Morgays. Silver bells on the falcon's jesses tinkled as she shifted on the handler's gauntlet. "Thank you, but I have had enough of hawking for today," Morgays told him, then raised her voice. "Master Gil, gather the escort. I am returning to the city." Gil gave a start. He knew very well that all he was there for was to ride at her heels, but he began waving and shouting orders to the white cloaks as if he believed they would obey. For her part, Morgays turned her black mare immediately. She did not take the animal faster than a walk, of course. Norwyn would have been on her like a flash if he saw a possibility she was considering escape. As it was, the cloakless white cloaks were galloping to form up their escort before the mare had gone 10 steps, and before she reached the edge of the meadow, Norwyn was at her side, a dozen men ahead and the rest close behind. The servants and musicians and falconers were left to gather themselves up and follow as quickly as they could. Gil and Piter took their places behind her, and then came the ladies-in-waiting. Miranda wore her smile like a badge of triumph now, though some of the others frowned in disapproval. Not too openly. Even if she had had to yield to Niall, the woman was a force to be reckoned with in Amadicia, but most of them did try to do their best at a task they did not want. For the greater part, they would likely have attended Morgay's willingly. It was residing inside the Fortress of the Light they did not like. Morgay's would have smiled herself if she could be sure Miranda would not see it. The only reason she had not insisted weeks ago that the woman be sent away was how free she was with her tongue. Miranda enjoyed pricking her with how far Andor had fallen from her grasp, but the names she chose were a balm to Morgay's. All men and women who had opposed her during the succession, all sycophants of Gabriel. She expected no less of them and no more. Had Miranda named others, the result would have been different. Lord Pellivar, or Abella, or Luan, Lady Arathella, or Elorian, or Aemlyn, others. They had never been part of Miranda's stabs, and they would have been if even a whisper from Andor had made her think of them. So long as Miranda did not mention them, there was at least hope that they had not knelt to Althor. They had supported Morgaze's first claim to the throne, and they might yet again, the light willing. Nearly leafless forest gave way to a road of hard-packed dirt, and they took it south toward Amador. Stretches of woods alternated with coppiced trees and fallow stone-fenced fields, with thatch-roofed stone houses and barns standing well back from the road. A good many people crowded the way, raising dust that made Morgay's tie a silk kerchief across her face, though they scrambled aside onto the verge at the first glimpse of such a large party of armed and armored men. Some even darted into the trees, or leaped fences and scurried across the fields. The white cloaks ignored them, and no farmers appeared to shake a fist or shout at the trespassers. Several of the farms had an abandoned look, with no chickens or animals in sight. Among the people on the road there was an ox-cart here, a man with a few sheep there, somewhere else a young woman herding a flock of geese. Plainly they were all local people. Some had a bundle shouldered or a fat scrip, but most were empty-handed, walking as if with no idea where they were going. The numbers of the latter sort had increased every time Morgay's had been allowed to leave Amador, no matter in which direction. Adjusting the kerchief over her nose, Morgay's eyed Norwynn sideways. He was about Talanvor's age and height, but there the resemblance ended. Red-faced under his burnished conical helmet and peeling from the sun, he had never been handsome. A lanky build and a thrusting nose made her think of a pickaxe. Every time she left the Fortress of the Light, he led her escort, and every time she tried to engage him in conversation. White cloak or not, every inch she could shift him from being her jailer was a victory. Are these people refugees from the Prophet, Norwynn? They could not all be, as many were heading north as south. No, he said curtly, without even glancing at her. His eyes scanned the roadsides as if he expected a rescue to appear for her any moment. That, unfortunately, was the sort of response she had had so far, but she persevered. Who are they, then? Not Taraboners, surely. You do a very good job of moving them on. She had seen a party of Taraboners, 50 or so men, women, and children, dirty and half-falling with weariness, being herded west like cattle by mounted white cloaks. Only the bitter knowledge that she could do absolutely nothing had enabled her to hold her tongue. Amadicia is a rich land. Even this drought cannot have driven so many from their farms in just a few months. Norwynn's face worked. No, he said finally. They are refugees from the false dragon. But how? He is hundreds of leagues from Amadicia. Again a struggle was plain on the man's sunburned face, either for words or against speaking. They believe he is the true dragon reborn, he said at last, sounding disgusted. They say he has broken all bonds according to the prophecies. Men forsake their lords, apprentices desert their masters, husbands abandon their families and wives their husbands. It is a plague carried on the wind, a wind that blows from the false dragon. Morgaze's eyes fell on a young man and woman huddled in each other's arms, watching her party pass. Sweat streaked the dirt on their faces, and dust coated their plain clothes. They looked hungry, their cheeks sunken, their eyes too big. Could this be happening in Andor? Had Randall Thor done this to Andor, too? If he has, he will pay. The problem was making sure the cure was not worse than the disease. To deliver Andor, even from this, and hand it to the White Cloaks. She tried to keep the conversation going, but having delivered himself of more words than he had ever before spoken to her at one time, Norwynn retreated into monosyllables. It did not matter. If she could crack his reserve once, she could again. Twisting in her saddle, she tried to see the young man and woman, but they were hidden behind the White Cloak soldiers. That did not matter either. Those faces would reside in her memory, alongside her promise.
Chapter 10. A Saying in the Borderlands. For a moment, Rand wished for the days when he could have strolled the palace corridors alone. This morning he was accompanied by Suolin and 20 maidens, by Bale, clan chief of the Goshin Aiel, with half a dozen Sovin Nai, knife hands, from the Jirad Goshin, for Bale's honor, and by Bashir with as many of his hawk-nosed Saldaeans. They crowded the broad, tapestry-hung hallway, the Cadensor-clad Fardarais Mai and Sovin Nai staring through servants who bowed or curtsied hastily and got out of the way, and the younger Saldaeans swaggering in their short coats and their baggy breeches tucked into their boots. It was hot even here in the shaded passage, and dust motes danced in the air. Some of the servants wore the red and white livery they had worn when Morghais ruled, but most were new, garbed in whatever they had on when they came applying for the job. A motley collection of farmers and tradesmen's woolens, mainly dark and plain, but running the range of colors, with here and there splashes of embroidery or bits of lace. Rand made a mental note to have Mistress Harfor, the first maid, find livery enough to go around, so the newcomers would not feel required to work in their best clothes. Palace livery was certainly finer than anything country folk had, except for perhaps feast days. The servants numbered fewer than in Morghais's day, and a good many of the red and white attired men and women were gray and stooped, out of the pensioners' quarters. Instead of fleeing when so many others did, they had quit their retirement rather than see the palace become run down. Another mental note, have Mistress Harfor. First maid was an unprepossessing title, but Rena Harfor ran the royal palace day to day. Find enough servants so these oldsters could enjoy their pensions. Were the pensions still being paid with Morghais dead? He should have thought of that before. Holwyn Norrie, the chief clerk, would know. It was like being beaten to death with feathers. Everything reminded him of something else to be done. The ways. That was no feather. He had the waygate here in Camelin under guard, and those near Tyr and Cairhien. But he could not even be sure how many more there were. Yes, he would have traded all the bows and curtsies, all the honor guards, all the questions and burdens, all the people whose needs had to be met, for the days when he had to worry about providing a coat for himself. Of course, in those days, he would not have been allowed to stroll these corridors at all, certainly not without a different sort of guard, one to make sure he did not slip a silver and gold chalice from its niche in the wall, or an ivory carving from a lapis-inlaid table. At least Luz Theron's voice was not muttering at him this morning. At least he seemed to be getting the way of the mental trick Taim had shown him. Sweat trickled down Bashir's face, but the heat hardly touched Rand. He wore his silver-embroidered coat of gray silk buttoned to the neck, and if he felt a little warm, he did not sweat a drop. Taim assured him that in time he would not even feel heat or cold great enough to disable another man. It was a matter of distancing himself, of concentrating inward, a little like the way he prepared to embrace Sidene. Strange that it should be so close to the power, yet have nothing to do with it at all. Did Aes Sedai do the same? He had never seen one sweat. Had he? Abruptly he laughed out loud, wondering whether Aes Sedai ever sweated. Maybe he was not mad yet, but he could pass fair for a wool-headed fellow. "Did I say something funny?" Bashir asked dryly, knuckling his mustaches. Some of the maidens looked at him expectantly. They were making an effort to understand Wetlander humor. How Bashir kept his equanimity, Rand did not know. A rumor had reached the palace that very morning of fighting in the borderlands between borderlanders. Travelers' tales sprang up like weeds after rain, but this had come from the north, apparently with merchants who had been at least as far as Tarvalin. Nothing in it said where or who exactly. Saldaya was as likely as anywhere else, and Bashir had had no word from there since he left months ago. Yet he might have heard that the price of turnips had risen for all the effect the rumor had had on him. Of course, Rand knew nothing of what was going on in the Two Rivers, either, unless vague mutters of an uprising somewhere in the west touched his home. In these days, that could be anything or nothing. But it was not the same for him. He had abandoned the Two Rivers. Aes Sedai had spies everywhere, and he would not wager a copper that the Forsaken did not as well. The Dragon Reborn had no interest in the fly-speck village where Randall Thor had grown up. He was far beyond that. If he was not, then Emmons Field was a hostage to use against him. Still, he would not split hairs with himself. Abandonment was abandonment. "If I could find a way to escape my destiny, do I deserve to?" That was his own thought, not Luz Theron's. Shifting shoulders that suddenly seemed to ache dully, he kept his voice light. "Forgive me, Bashir. Something odd just occurred to me. But I have been listening. You were saying Camelin is filling up? For every man who ran away because he was afraid of the false dragon, two have come because I'm not and he isn't? You see?" Bashir grunted, which might have meant anything. "How many have come for other reasons, Randall Thor?" Bale was the tallest man Rand had ever seen, a good hand taller than Rand himself. He made an odd contrast with Bashir, who stood shorter than any of the maidens except Anila. Gray streaked thickly through Bale's dark reddish hair, but his face was lean and hard, his blue eyes sharp. "You have enemies enough for 100 men. Mark me, they will try to strike at you again. There could even be shadow runners among them."
"Even if there are no dark friends," Bashir put in, "trouble brews in the city like tea left on the boil. A number of people have been severely beaten, evidently for doubting you're the Dragon Reborn, and one poor fellow was hauled from a tavern into a barn and hanged from the rafters for laughing at your miracles."
"My miracles?" Rand said incredulously. A wrinkled, white-haired serving man, in a too-large coat of livery, with a large vase in his hands, trying to bow and step out of the way at the same time, tripped on his heel and fell backward. The pale green vase, paper-thin seafolk porcelain, flew over his head and went tumbling end over end across the dark red floor tiles, spinning and bouncing until it came to rest, upright, 30 or so paces down the hall. The old man scrambled to his feet with surprising spryness and ran to snatch up the vase, running his hands over it and exclaiming in disbelief as much as relief when he found not a chip or a crack. Other servants stared with just as much incredulity, before abruptly coming to themselves and hurrying on about their tasks. They avoided looking at Rand so hard that several forgot to bow or curtsy. Bashir and Bale exchanged looks, and Bashir blew out his thick mustaches.
"Strange occurrences, then," he said. "Every day there's another story about a child falling headfirst onto paving stones from a window 40 feet up, without so much as a single bruise, or a grandmother getting in the way of 2 dozen runaway horses, only somehow they don't even buffet her, much less knock her down and trample her. Some fellow threw 5 crowns 22 times straight at dice the other day, and they laid that at your feet, too. Luckily for him."
"It is said," Bale added, "that yesterday a basket of roof tiles fell from a roof and landed in the street unbroken in the shape of the ancient symbol of the Aes Sedai."
He glanced at the open-mouthed, white-haired servant, clutching the vase to his chest as they passed.
"I do not doubt that it did."
Rand exhaled slowly. They did not mention the other sort, of course. The man who stumbled on a step and was hanged when his kerchief caught on the door latch, the loose slate ripped from a roof by a high wind that sailed through an open window, and a doorway to kill a woman sitting at table with her family. The sort of thing that did happen, but rarely. Only such things were not rare around him. For good or ill, for ill as often as good, he twisted chance merely by being within a few miles. No, if the dragons disappeared from his arms and the branded herons from his palms, he was still marked. There was a saying in the borderlands, "Duty is heavier than a mountain, death lighter than a feather." Once you had that mountain firmly on your shoulders, there was no way to put it down. There was no one else to carry it anyway, and no use whining about it. He made his voice brisk. "Have you found the men who did the hanging?" Bashir shook his head. "Then find them and arrest them for murder. I want a stop put to this. Doubting me isn't a crime." Rumor said the Prophet had made it one, but there was nothing he could do about that yet. He did not even know where Massima was, beyond somewhere in Gildan or Amadisia. If he had not gone elsewhere meantime. Yet another note chalked up in his head. He had to find the man and rein him somehow. "No matter how far it goes," Bashir said, "there are whispers you're a false dragon who killed Morghese with Aes Sedai help. The people are supposed to rise up against you and avenge their queen. There may be more than one someone. It isn't clear." Rand's face hardened. The first part he could live with. He had to. There were too many variations to stamp out however many times he denied it. But he would not tolerate incitement to rebellion. Andar would be one land he did not split apart in war. He would give Elaine a land as unblemished as it had come to him. If he ever found her, he would. "Find who began it," he said harshly, "and toss them in prison." Light, how to find who started a whisper. If they seek pardon, they can ask Elaine for it. A young serving woman in a rough brown dress, dusting a blue spun-glass bowl, caught sight of his face, and the bowl dropped from her suddenly shaking hands and shattered. He did not always alter chance. "Is there any good news? I could do with some." The young woman bent unsteadily to gather up the shards of the bowl, but Sulin glanced at her, just glanced, and she sprang back, flattening herself wide-eyed against a tapestry showing a leopard hunt. Rand did not understand it, but some women seemed more frightened of the maidens than they did of Aiel men. The young woman looked at Bale as if hoping he would protect her. He did not appear to see her at all.
"That depends on how you define good news," Bashir shrugged. "I've learned that Elorian of House Tremaine and Pelivar of House Curlan entered the city 3 days ago. Sneaked in, you might say, and neither has come near the inner city that I've heard. Talk in the streets is Dylan of House Terravin in the country nearby. None of them has responded to your invitations. I've heard nothing to connect any of them to the whispers."
He glanced at Bale, who gave a slight shake of his head.
"We hear less than you, Davram Bashir. These people speak more freely around wetlanders."
It was good news, in any case.
Those were people Rand needed. If they believed him a false dragon, he could find a way around that. If they believed he had killed Morghese, well, so much the better if they remained loyal to her memory and her blood. "Send them fresh invitations to visit me. Include Dylan's name. They may know where she is."
"If I send such an invitation," Bashir said doubtfully, "it may do no more than remind them there's a Saldaean army in Andor."
Rand hesitated, then nodded, suddenly grinning.
"Ask the Lady Aramilla to carry it. I don't doubt she'll leap at the chance to show them how close she is to me. But you write it out."
Moraine's lessons in playing the game of houses were coming in useful once more.
"I do not know whether it is good news or bad," Bale said,
but the Red Shields tell me two Aes Sedai have taken rooms at an inn in the new city.
The Red Shields had been helping Bashir's men police Camelin, and were now taking it over alone. Bale grinned slightly at the chagrin on Bashir's face.
We hear less, Devrim Bashir, but perhaps sometimes we see more.
Is one of them our friend who likes cats? Rand asked. The stories of an Aes Sedai in the city persisted. Sometimes there were two or three, or a whole party. The closest Bashir or Bale had come to anything at all, though, were a few stories of an Aes Sedai who healed dogs and cats. But always the next street over, told by someone who had been told by someone who had heard it in a tavern or in the market. Bale shook his head.
I do not think so. The Red Shield said these two seem to have arrived in the night.
Bashir looked interested. He seldom let an opportunity pass to repeat that Rand needed Aes Sedai, but Bale was frowning slightly, so slightly it would not have been noticeable on anyone but an Aiel. Aiel were careful in their dealings with Aes Sedai, even reluctant. Those few words contained plenty for Rand to think on, and every path came back to himself. Two Aes Sedai had to have a reason to come into Camelin when their sisters were avoiding the city since he appeared there. The most likely reason was something to do with him. In the best of times, few people journeyed by night, and these were not the best of times. Aes Sedai arriving in the dark might be trying to avoid notice, and the most likely notice for them to avoid was his. On the other hand, they might just be going somewhere urgently, which could spell a mission for the tower. The truth of it was, he could not think what might be more important to the tower right now than himself. Or they might be on their way to join the Aes Sedai that Egwene insisted were going to support him. Whatever it was, he wanted to know. The light alone knew what the Aes Sedai were up to, the tower or Elaine's hidden lot, but he had to find out. There were too many of them, and they could be too dangerous for him not to. How would the tower react when Elida learned of his amnesty? How would any Aes Sedai? Had they heard yet? As they approached the doors at the end of the corridor, he opened his mouth to tell Bale to ask one of the Aes Sedai to come to the palace. He could handle two Aes Sedai if it came to that, so long as they did not catch him by surprise, but there was no point taking chances until he knew who they were and what they were about.
Pride fills me. I am sick with the pride that destroyed me.
Rand missed a step. That was the first time today that Luce Theron's voice had spoken inside his head, and too much like a comment on his thoughts of Aes Sedai for comfort. But it was not what made him swallow what he had been going to say and stop dead. Because of the heat, the doors stood open, giving out into one of the palace gardens. The flowers were gone, and some of the rose and white star bushes looked wilted. But the shade trees still stood, if with few leaves, around the white marble fountain that splashed in the garden's heart. A woman in bulky brown wool skirts and a loose white algoda blouse stood beside the fountain, a gray shawl looped over her arms, staring in wonder, as she often did, at water with no use except to be looked at. Rand's eyes drank in the lines of Avienda's face, the waves of reddish hair falling to her shoulders from the folded gray scarf fastened around her temples. Light, but she was beautiful. Studying the spray of water, she had not seen him yet. Did he love her? He did not know. She was all tangled in his head and his dreams with Elaine and even Min. What he did know was that he was dangerous. He had nothing to offer any woman except pain.
Ilyena,
Luce Theron wept.
I killed her. The light consumed me forever.
A pair of Aes Sedai showing up like that might be important, Rand said quietly. I think I should visit this inn and see why they're here. Almost everyone stopped when he did, but Inila and Jelani exchanged glances and kept on right past him toward the garden. He raised his voice a fraction and hardened it considerably more. The maidens here will come with me. Anyone who wants to put on a dress and discuss matchmaking can stay behind. Inila and Jelani stiffened and spun to face him, indignation lighting their eyes. A good thing Samara was not in today's guard. She might have gone on anyway. Sulin's fingers flashed in maiden hand talk, and whatever she had to say, it quenched indignation and set embarrassed flames in the two maidens' cheeks instead. The Aiel had all sorts of hand signals for when silence was best. Every clan had its private set, and every society as well, besides which there were those all the Aiel knew. But only the maidens had made a language of them. Rand did not wait for Sulin to finish before turning away from the garden. These Aes Sedai might leave Camlann as quickly as they had come. He glanced over his shoulder. Avienda was still staring at the water. She had not seen him. He quickened his step. "Bashir, would you send one of your men to have horses readied?" "At the south stable gate." The main gates of the palace opened onto the Queen's Plaza, which would be full of people hoping for a glimpse of him. It would have taken half an hour to make a way through, if he was lucky. Bashir motioned, and one of the younger Saldaeans loped ahead in that rolling stride of a man more used to a saddle.
"A man must know when to retreat from a woman," Bashir said to the heir. "But a wise man knows that sometimes he must stand and face her."
"Young men," Bale said indulgently.
"A young man chases shadows and runs from moonlight, and in the end he stabs himself in the foot with his own spear."
Some of the other Aiel chuckled, maidens and knife hands alike. The older ones did. Irritated, Rand looked over his shoulder again. "Neither of you would look well in a dress." Surprisingly, the maidens and knife hands laughed again, more loudly. Maybe he was getting a grip on Aiel humor. It was as he expected when he rode out of the south stable gate into one of the inner city's curving streets. Jadon's hooves rang out on the paving stones as the stallion frisked. The Dapple seldom got out of the stable of late. There were plenty of people in the street, but nowhere near the numbers to be expected on the other side of the palace, and all going about their own business. Even so, fingers pointed and people leaned close to one another, murmuring. Some might have recognized Bashir. Unlike Rand, he had been out and about in the city often. But anybody emerging from the palace, especially with an escort of trotting Aiel, had to be important. The murmurs and pointing fingers followed. Despite the stares, Rand tried to enjoy the beauties of the Ogier-built inner city. The few occasions he found to just enjoy anything were precious. Streets curved out from the shining white royal palace, flowing along the contours of the hills like a part of the land. Everywhere stood slender towers covered in colored tiles, or domes of gold or purple or white sparkling in the sunlight. Here a line of sight had been left clear to give a view of tree-filled park. There a rise through the eyes across the city to the rolling plains and forests beyond the tall silver-streaked white wall that enclosed all of Camlann. The inner city had been laid out to delight and soothe the eye. According to the Ogier, only Tarvalin itself and storied Menetherin had ever surpassed it, and many humans, Andorans foremost among them, believe that Camlann matched either. The pure white walls of the inner city marked the beginning of the surrounding new city with its own domes and spires, some trying to match the height of those in the inner city on its higher hills. Here the narrower streets were packed full of humanity, and even the broad boulevards, split down the middle by tree-lined expanses, were filled with people and ox-carts and horse-drawn wagons, folk on horseback and in carriages and sedan chairs. A buzz hung in the air, as from a huge hive of bees. Passage was slower here, though the crowds gave way. They did not know who he was, any more than did those in the inner city, but no one wanted to get in the way of striding Aiel. It simply took time with so many people. And there was every sort of person. Farmers in rough woolens and merchants in coats or dresses of finer cut. Craftsmen hurrying about their trades and hawkers crying their wares from trays and pushcarts, everything from pins and ribbons to fruit and fireworks, the last two equally dear now. A gleeman in his patch-covered cloak rubbed shoulders with three Aiel inspecting the blades displayed on tables before a cutler's workshop. Two lean fellows with their dark hair in braids and swords on their backs, hunters for the horn, Rand expected, stood chatting with a number of Saldaeans as they listened to a woman playing the flute and a man the tambour on a street corner. Karienin, shorter and paler, stood out among the Andorans, and so did the darker Tyrans, but Rand saw Mirandians in long coats and Altarans in elaborate vests, fork-bearded Kandori, even a pair of Domani with long, thin mustaches and earrings. Another sort of people stood out, too, those who wandered about in rumpled coats and wrinkled dresses, often dusty and always blinking and staring, plainly with nowhere to go and no idea of what to do next. That sort had gone as far as they could go toward what they sought. Him. The dragon reborn. What he was to do with them he had no notion, yet they were his responsibility, one way or another. No matter that he had not asked them to throw over their lives, had not wanted them to abandon everything. They had, because of him. And if they learned who he was, they might well overwhelm the Aiel and tear him apart in their eagerness just to touch him. He touched the fat little man Angriol in his coat pocket. A fine thing, if it came to him using the one power to protect himself against people who had given up everything because of him. That was why he seldom ventured into the city. One reason, anyway. There was just too much to be done to go for an idle ride. The inn Bale led him to, toward the western end of the city, was called Culain's Hound. 3 stories of stone with a red tile roof. On the twisting side street, the passing throng backed up both ways, narrowing to crowd around Rand's party when it stopped. Rand touched the Angriol again. 2 Aes Sedai, he should be able to handle them without resorting to that, before dismounting and going in. Not before 3 maidens in a pair of knife hands, of course, all on their toes, and a hair from veiling. He could have taught a cat to sing first. Leaving 2 Saldaeans with the horses, Bashir and the others strode in at his heels, along with Bale, the rest of the Aiel following, except for those who had taken up guard outside. What they found was not what Rand expected. The common room could have changed places with any of 100 or more in Camelin. Great barrels of ale and wine lining one plain plastered wall, topped with smaller casks of brandy, and a gray-striped cat sprawled on top of all, a pair of stone fireplaces, the hearths swept bare, and 3 or 4 aproned serving women moving among tables and benches scattered around a bare wooden floor beneath a beamed ceiling. The innkeeper, a round-faced man with 3 chins, a white apron straining around his bulk, trotted up washing his hands and eyeing the Aiel only a touch nervously. Camelin had learned they were not going to pillage and burn everything in sight, convincing the Aiel that Andor was not a conquered land and they could not take the 5th, had been a harder proposition. But that was not to say innkeepers were used to having 2 dozen appear in their common rooms at once. The innkeeper concentrated on Rand and Bashir, mainly on Bashir. Both men were clearly men of substance by their clothes, but Bashir was the elder by a good many years, and thus likely to be the more important.
"Welcome, my lord, my lords. What may I offer you? I have wines from Murundi, as well as Andorin, brandy from—"
Rand ignored the man. What was not like 100 other common rooms was the patrons. At this hour he would have expected 1 or 2 men, perhaps, but there were none. Instead, most of the tables were filled with plainly dressed young women, girls, really, for the most part, who twisted around on their benches, teacups in hand, to gawk at the new arrivals. More than one gasped at Bale's height. Not all of them stared at the Aiel, though, and it was the near dozen who gaped at him that made Rand's eyes widen. He knew them. Not all well, but he did know them. One in particular seized his attention.
"Bode?" he said in disbelief.
That big-eyed girl staring at him, when had she gotten old enough to put her hair in a braid, was Bodewyn Cawthon, Matt's sister. And there was plump Hilda Baron sitting next to skinny Geraldine Alcar, and pretty Marisa Ahan,
with her hands clapped to her cheeks the way she always did when surprised, and buxom Emery Lewin, and Elise Marwin, and Daria Candwin, and... They were from Emmons Field, or close by. Darting a look over the rest of the tables, he realized the others must be Two Rivers girls, too. Most of them, anyway. He saw a Domani face, and one or two more that might be from off. But every dress could have been seen any day on the green in Emmons Field. "What under the light are you doing here?"
"We are on our way to Tarvalen,"
Bode managed, despite gaping. The only thing about her that looked at all like Matt was a mischievous something around the eyes. Her astonishment at seeing him vanished quickly in a broad smile of wonder and delight.
"To become Aes Sedai, like Egwene and Nynaeve."
"We could ask the same of you," Willowy Lurene A. Ellen put in, arranging her thick braid over her shoulder with studied casualness.
The oldest of the Emmons Field girls, a good 3 years younger than him, but the only one besides Bode to have her hair braided, she had always had a good opinion of herself. She was pretty enough for all the boys to have confirmed it for her.
"Lord Perrin hardly said two words about you except to say you were off having adventures and wearing fine coats, which I see you are."
"Is Matt well?"
Bode asked, suddenly anxious.
"Is he with you? Mother worries about him so. He wouldn't even remember to put on clean stockings if someone didn't tell him."
"No," Rand said slowly, "he's not here. But he is well."
"We hardly expected to find you in Camelin," Jancy Torfin piped up in her high voice.
She could not be more than 14. She was the youngest, at least among the Emmons Fielders.
"Verin Sedai and Alana Sedai will be pleased, I'll wager. They're always asking what we know about you."
So those were the two Aes Sedai. He knew Verin, a brown sister, more than slightly. He did not know what to think about her being here, though. That was hardly most important anyway. These girls were from home. "Everything is all right in the Two Rivers, then? In Emmons Field? Perrin got there all right, it seems." "Wait. Lord Perrin?" That opened the sluice gate. The rest of the Two Rivers girls were more interested in studying the Aiel with sidelong peaks, especially Bale, and a few spared glances for the Saldaeans, but the Emmons Field girls crowded around Rand, all trying to tell him everything at once, all jumbled up and wrong way round, interspersed with questions about himself and Matt, about Egwene and Nynaeve, most of which he could not have answered in under an hour had they given him a chance. Trollocs had invaded the Two Rivers, but Lord Perrin drove them off. They went on so about the great battle, everyone talking at the same time, that it was hard to pick out any details except that there had been one. Everybody fought, of course, but it had been Lord Perrin who saved everybody. Always Lord Perrin. Any time he said just Perrin, they corrected him in the perfunctory way they might someone who said horse when he should have said sawhorse. Even with the news that the Trollocs were beaten, Rand's chest tightened. He had abandoned them to this. If he had gone, there might not have been such a long list of the dead, so many names that he knew. But if he had gone, he would not have the Aiel behind him. Cairhien would not be his, as much as it was, and Ravan would likely be sending a united Andor against him and the Two Rivers. There was a price to be paid for any decision he made. There was a price for who he was. Other people paid it. He had to keep reminding himself that it was a far smaller price than they would pay without him. The reminder did not help much, though. Taking his expression for dismay at the listing of Two Rivers dead, the girls hastened on to happier things. It seemed Perrin had married Fael, too. Rand wished him happiness in that, and wondered how long any happiness they found could last. The girls thought it romantic and wonderful, and only seemed to regret that there had been no time for the usual wedding parties. They were quite approving of Fael, quite admiring, and a touch envious, even Lorene. There had been white cloaks, too, and with them Padan Fain, the old peddler, who used to come to Emmons Field every spring. The girls seemed unsure whether the white cloaks had been friends or enemies, but to Rand, Fane made the difference, if there was any real doubt. Fane was a dark friend, maybe worse than a dark friend, who would do anything to harm Rand and Matt and Perrin, especially Rand. Maybe the worst news they had to tell him was that no one knew whether Fane was dead. In any case, the White Cloaks were gone, the Trollocs were gone, and refugees were flooding in across the mountains of mist, bringing all sorts of new things, from customs to trades, plants and seeds to clothes. One of the other girls was a Damani, and there were two Terrabonners, and three from Almuth Plain.
"Loreen bought a Damani dress," little Jancy laughed, cutting her eyes. "But her mother made her take it back to the seamstress."
Loreen raised her hand, then thought better of it, and simply rearranged her braid with a sniff. Jancy giggled.
"Who cares about dresses?" Susa Alcine exclaimed. "Rand doesn't care about dresses."
A slight fluttery girl, Susa had always been excitable, and right now she was bouncing on her toes.
"Alana Sedai and Varen Sedai tested everybody. Well, almost everybody. Celia Cole wanted to be tested, too," Marse Eldon, a stocky girl, put in.
Rand did not much remember her, except that she had always had her nose in a book, even walking in the street.
"She insisted. She passed, but they told her she was too old to be a novice."
Susa went right on over, Marse.
"And we all passed. We've been traveling all day and practically all night since Whitebridge," Bode put in. "It is so good to stay in one place a little while." "Have you seen Whitebridge, Rand?" Jancy said on top of Bode. "The Whitebridge itself?" "And we're going to Tar Valon to become Aes Sedai,"
Susa finished with a glare that took in Bode, Mars, and Jancy.
"In Tar Valon."
"We will not be going to Tar Valon just yet."
The voice from the door to the street spun the girls' attention from Rand, but the two Aes Sedai just coming in waved aside their questions offhandedly. The Aes Sedai's regard was all for Rand. They were disparate women, despite the common length of their faces. Either could have been any age at all, but Varen was short and plump, square-faced, with a touch of gray in her hair, while the other, who must be Alana, was dark and slender, a beautiful vulpine woman with waves of black hair and a light in her eyes that spoke of a temper, and with a slight redness around them, as if she had been crying, though Rand could hardly believe an Aes Sedai weeping. Her riding dress was gray silk, slashed with green, and looked as if she had just donned it, while Varen's pale brown appeared slightly rumpled. If Varen paid little heed to her clothes, though, her dark eyes were sharp enough. They latched onto Rand as tightly as muscles on a rock. Two men in dull green coats followed them into the common room, one stocky and gray-haired, the other a tall, dark whip of a man, but each had a sword on his hip, and the fluid way they moved would have named them warders even without the Aes Sedai. They ignored Rand entirely, instead watching the Aiel and Saldaeans with a stillness that spoke of sudden movement in check. For their part, the Aiel did not move exactly, but there was an air of veils going up about them, maidens and knife hands alike, and the young Saldaeans' fingers suddenly hovered near sword hilts. Only Bale and Bashir appeared truly at ease. The girls noticed nothing except the Aes Sedai, but the fat innkeeper sensed the mood and began wringing his hands, no doubt seeing his common room destroyed, if not his whole inn. "There will be no trouble," Rand said loudly and levelly, for the innkeeper, for the Aiel. For everyone, he hoped. "No trouble unless you start it, Varen." Several of the girls goggled at him, speaking so to an Aes Sedai, and Loreen sniffed loudly. Varen studied him with bird-like eyes.
"Who are we to start trouble near you? You have come far since I saw you last."
For some reason, he did not want to talk about that. "If you've decided not to go to Tar Valon, then you must have heard the tower is broken." That caused a startled buzz among the girls. They certainly had not heard. The Aes Sedai gave no reaction at all.
"Do you know where those who oppose Elida are?" "There are things we should discuss in private," Elana said calmly. "Master Dillam, we will need your private dining room."
The innkeeper nearly fell over himself, assuring her that it was at her disposal. Varen started toward a side door.
"This way, Rand."
Alana looked at him, raising a questioning eyebrow. Rand held in a wry grin. They had just walked in and taken charge, but it seemed that Aes Sedai did that as naturally as breathing. The Two Rivers girls stared at him with varying degrees of commiseration. Doubtless they expected the Aes Sedai to skin him if he did not speak right and sit straight. Perhaps Varen and Alana did, too. With a smooth bow, he motioned for Alana to precede him. So he had come a long way, Addie. They had no idea how far. Alana acknowledged his bow with a nod, gathered her skirts, and glided after Varen. But trouble followed immediately. The two warders made as if to trail the Aes Sedai, and before they had taken a full step, a pair of cold-eyed,